Welcome to Augmented Humanity. Our guests are modern explorers working at the intersection of technology and the humanities. They help us to understand ourselves and the worlds we create in this digital age. They are thinkers, creators, makers, and academics working in diverse fields like comparative religion, civics and government, law, and anthropology. I'm your host, Craig Goldsmith.
I'm your host, Ellen Dornan.
We're joined today by Dr. Darryl Rowe, Assistant Professor of Communication at Eastern New Mexico University in Portales. Since 2016, Dr. Rowe has focused much of his work on the influence that digital media exert on modern audiences. He focuses on political communication and data-driven analysis of media rhetoric, particularly on digital platforms such as Twitter. We'd like to speak with you a little bit about some of your definitions and concepts and how you approach analyzing these digital social interactions, I guess, for lack of a better word. I don't always like to focus on whether it's Twitter or something else, but these kind of social interactions that people are using these days. So could you maybe go through some of those with us?
Yes. Do we want to look at schema theory, perhaps?
Sure.
Schema theory is not all that well known, perhaps, in the communication field, but it certainly came out of psychology, Piaget's research, and then some other ones, because schema deals with how we perceive reality. How do we build blocks of reality literally in our heads? I mean, you can't see in somebody's brain what they're thinking, but you can sort of deduce that they are making sense of reality with building blocks that they learned from day one, from childhood on up. But that reality can develop and change. It can become more or less realistic, I suppose. It can become distorted in some ways. And it's because that some cognitive psychologists think that whatever messages or visual or verbal information that comes in through our senses causes us to reevaluate and adapt our way of thinking about any particular topic. I mean, we could be talking about a tree, and we would all in our minds have a picture, an image of what a tree is. But if you'd just gotten back from an expedition into the heart of the Amazon jungle, and I said to you, tree, you would have greatly expanded your schema probably about tree, the idea of tree-ness, if you will, and that would be greatly different from someone who had grown up and lived all their life in Manhattan or something, perhaps. I mean, you still know what a tree is, but quite a enhancement of one's reality, if you will, and modifications and changing. And we also get stereotypes this way because people may learn negative attributes associated with a few people, and from that their brain builds a schema of the entire population or whatever based on a few iconic references, and it's hard later on to change those even if correct information comes through or more positive information. But when the President of the United States puts out a schema of someone, and that schema has attached with it a lot of the things he says about people, or this person is very stupid or unintelligent, it's hard to not think about that person in that way because this just came from the highest office in the land. You just got a picture of this person. Now it's going to go into your schema, becomes a part of your framework for understanding that person.
You suggested that schema are our building blocks for evaluating the world, using our intelligence maybe to predict what's going to happen next or to fit things into some kind of model, because that speeds our way through the world. I'm using intelligence here in the broad sense. And you said that this comes to us through our senses, whether it's hearing, sight, touch. We start building these schema as very young people, and they can be hard to change. But then when you started talking about the president's tweets, you seem to be suggesting that he's trying to affect schema building in his audience.
From an academic point of view, I can see that that's happening. That, for example, from his point of view, Democrats are obstructionists. Democrats only want to do things to impede what he's trying to do because they don't like him. Democrats are angry, thoughtless people. I may be offended by that. I may think, well, that's just a broad generalization, but I still got the picture, you see. Mm-hmm. Once that picture's been painted or that model's been put out there, it still gets adapted by the human brain. It becomes part of my way I interpret reality. For example, let's say a child grows up and at some point he has a scary encounter with a dog. Later on, this person may have be afraid of dogs because they just they associate it. Maybe they don't even remember what the original thing was, but dogs are dangerous. How did this ever happen? He may have to go through hypnosis or something to find out what was the original deal, but that got into his schema, and it's almost impossible now since it's at the foundation of that picture in his mind that this is what the whole, all of them are like that, you know, and so forth. So the kind of negative images we're getting about particular Democrats or anyone really could be Republican who opposes where Trump wants to go with policy, the economy, border immigration issues, the wall. If someone is against that, they get painted in a very negative light. Wait a minute now. I know some Democrats and that doesn't apply, but I've got the image. What am I going to do with it?
In your paper, Targeted by the Tweeter-in-Chief, Tracking Trump's Twitter Insults in Year One, and we see examples where he sort of floats a schema, wacky Tom Steyer or a flunky Jake Tapper, and he just uses it once, but he doesn't really take off with it, as opposed to the two examples that emerge as some of the top, which is Crooked Hillary
Clinton. Crooked Hillary, yes.
Crooked Hillary and the failing New York Times. And
exactly.
I personally have trouble referencing the New York Times anymore without calling it the failing New York Times.
Despite the fact
that I know that subscriptions to the New York Times have only increased since Trump's election. I know that logically, I still need to refer to it as the failing New York Times.
So that would be like if I had a negative reference about a person of a certain social group or racial group, and even though I'm saying, no, that's negative, don't go there, it's still in there because it's been put in there by somebody somewhere, and I may not even know why.
Do you think that social media is better at propagating and maybe infecting us with these sorts of schema? And in times past, since we're talking about the digital age here in particular?
Probably so. It seems authentic because it's so emotion-laden. And we find this with studies of memes as well, that if you have a picture of some celebrity and they apparently said something, there's a quote there. They didn't say that. But people pass these on and they say, well, it feels right. It stirred me so much. I got angry when I saw that, or I laughed. And emotions don't lie. Emotions can't be wrong. And so words get out in the social media and they get passed along because we kind of like them or we want our friends to see them. And then they take a legitimacy of their own because they just keep getting disseminated. If our friends are sending it to us, it has a more reliable feeling to it.
So it's almost like it's pre-vetted.
Yes.
So, like
good
the way point. That the way that maybe we would be more accepting of a schema handed down to us from a parent or
good point
or a teacher.
And even later, if we learn different, it's sort of like I still have that reference in my mind and I don't know if I can ever get it out.
I did want to touch a little bit on the roadblocks you describe, and you talk about four roadblocks that are about judging. That would be criticizing, name-calling, diagnosing, and praising evaluatively.
Yes.
Sending solutions is another type of roadblocks. Ordering, threatening, moralizing, or excessive or inappropriate questioning.
Right.
And the final set of roadblocks are avoiding the other's concerns. So that's advising, diverting, presenting logical arguments that don't consider the emotional factors involved.
Right.
And reassuring. Mm-hmm, so it's sort of empty soothing
right.
there.
Right. There.
So yes. How do you see these generally?
When I looked at Pascual Ferra's research, I was glad to find it and but also surprised. And she got some of her terminology and thoughts from Bolton's work in 86. She did her work in 2006. But she took these top terms that you mentioned and she equated them with verbal aggression. And I thought, my, how novel. I mean, I probably wouldn't have made that connection. I'm glad she did, and I could then apply it to studies of Trump or whatever communication. But when you talk about things like insulting, well, that may be obvious. I mean, if you're insulting someone or condemning them or calling them names, that may be fairly clear that that's verbal aggression. You know, that's and if you're tweeting that about somebody, you know, he calls Elizabeth Warren Pocahontas and he calls Chuck Schumer crying Chuck. that's a roadblock, because now that you've done that, you've shut off the path of communication between them and for a while. But some of the ones that really surprised me on there, evaluative praise, for example, as a verbal aggression. Pasquale Ferra found that, and I've seen in Trump's tweets where he will praise someone who is doing what he likes for them to do or putting out the kind of message he likes, and then condemning someone who's doing the opposite. Or you can kind of see how the praise is manipulative or evaluative in some cases. Or some of those other ones, the diagnosing someone. I know what your problem is, playing amateur psychologist. You're doing this because you think or you believe this. It minimizes the person's contribution to the discussion, so to speak. If you were having a conversation with somebody, that would shut them down. It would, and that's the point of it, probably, but it's a roadblock to having constructive dialogue. And I must say this, that one of these skills that a person in a high executive position should have is the skill of a diplomat, the skill of a negotiator. If you're in the position of trying to use diplomacy, but yet you're shutting down the other person or devaluing their contributions, that's going to be a roadblock situation, not encouraging, but shutting it down. Threatening, like if we don't get what we want from North Korea, there's going to be hell to pay. That, you know, that's a pretty strong comment. But also things like moralizing. You know what the best thing would be to do would be if these Democrats in the Senate would do the right thing for our country. We are a great nation, and we're waiting for them to do what's right. Doesn't that sound nice? And then you realize that was a manipulative point to try to get them to, but not stated as an insult, but just like, take the high road that I've defined, but still it's the high road. It shuts down any type of avenue of conversation because it makes it seem like, well, the person with the other point of view is just an idiot, basically.
Given that a lot of your work has been analyzing these sorts of ways of communicating on social media, what are the implications there? First, do you think that social media lends itself to these sorts of communication modalities, I guess is maybe the best word, whether it's priming, building these negative schema in the reading audience, in the case of Twitter, in the case of America anyway, where maybe Americans have liked to communicate in this way even prior to the digital platforms? That's something I wonder about quite a bit.
That's a great question. You know, the fear might be that we're social media, especially Twitter, and how it's sort of geared for the little short responses back and forth and such, and whatever the next good social media will be, or one that takes off really fast, that it's sort of taking us down a road. We're becoming less civilized as a society, but that's a big picture to see that far down the road. I don't know that that's what's maybe happening, but that it's tapping into something that's already, maybe as you said there, already part of our nature to, we kind of like to argue, as Americans especially, maybe not in other cultures around the world, they don't necessarily see arguing as a polite way of interacting, but we do kind of like to argue, especially about politics and things, and we don't mind telling other people that you're just a nut, frankly, or just shutting them, you know, just saying the little thing, yeah. Well, wait a minute, I've got a point of view here, but well, no, I disagree with your point of view, and we'd like to say this and say that, and I think maybe the social media platforms are more geared toward the unthoughtful, maybe unfiltered, but also the very quick kind of, it doesn't foster this grassroots town hall thing that it's supposed to be perhaps doing, where we let everybody contribute and respect everybody's ideas. No, it's like, who can slap the other guy before they slap him, kind of like a Three Stooges, is Mo going to slap Larry, or is Larry going to slap Curly? Who's going to slap who first, and who's going to get the most slaps? And it's, oh, okay, because there's some visceral, there's some sort of, adrenaline-fed, it just feels better when I'm taking my frustrations out on someone there. I don't think that's something new that's come about. It's just quicker now. It's less...
And immediate, and everybody can see it and read it practically in real time,
yes,
which I think
yes.
is unique to the digital age.
True, true.
It used to be you would have had to wait to read about it,
right.
And maybe it would have made it onto the evening news. Maybe it would have made it into the paper 2 days later or 3 days later. But instead, it's right there in real time popping up on your phone with your phone dinging every 30
exactly.
seconds.
That's very true.
I sometimes wonder if that's part of it, too, is that literally the physical part of your phone vibrating when a new tweet comes in, if that gives you that little, like,
Endorphin rush.
Endorphin rush is exactly what
Yes.
And it just makes you want to.
I'm part of it.
You're ugly. You're ugly too. You're ugly. No, you're uglier. No,
exactly.
Your mama.
Exactly. Exactly. And it gives it sort of a, you know, I know sometimes I've even posted some things knowing that it will get some kickback. And it's sort of like, I can't wait for this to, you know, see what the result is. I don't maybe go as far, but just sort of like, there's a little bit of a little thrill when you send that out there and you hit send or whatever, and it's like.
Oh, it's a big thrill. It's not a little thrill. It's a big, huge monster thrill.
Yes.
I know that's how I feel when I put something up that care about or that I'm emotionally invested in.
Right, right.
Augmented Humanity is a program of the New Mexico Humanities Council, produced in partnership with KUNM-FM. You can visit us online and find out more about our programs at nmhumanities.org. If you want to learn more about the topics and themes of today's discussion, you can find Dr. Darryl Rowe's papers at his website, darrylrowe.wixsite.com/rowresearch. Our theme music is by bassist James Whiten.